Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Hey, Happy New Year from Rome. It's Sunday, the 4th of January, 2009. This is Solder Smoke 98. Yeah, Happy New Year. We had a very nice New Year's Eve here in Rome. I'll tell you a little bit about it as part of our travelogue section. We're not really big on the whole New Year's Eve thing. Neither Elisa or I are drinkers. I'm pretty much a teetotaler, so that takes a lot of the wind out of the New Year's Eve sails, if you know what I mean. But it's a big important holiday, and we had friends over this year, and all of our friends brought over kids, lots of kids. So we had all kinds of kids here. New Year's Eve is not really a kids' event, as you guys know. Anyway, we brought the kids over, and all of them had taken naps of some length during the afternoon, so they were ready to go. Even the really little guys were ready to go. And we after dinner, we went out to the piazza and lit off fireworks. That's one great thing about living in a country that's not really too big on strict laws and regulations against everything. There's still quite a few things here that are permitted, and fireworks are among them, and fireworks are on sale. You know, if you look for fireworks around the 4th of July here, you're not going to find anything, but if you look for fireworks leading up to New Year's Eve, you're going to find them on sale in the tobacco shops. That's really where they sell them. You got to go to the tobacco shops. If you're in doubt in Italy about where to buy something, head to the tobacco shop. That's where you get everything from postage stamps to your Roman candles. So anyway, we went out and got a whole bunch of fireworks and prepared for the new year. Anyway, after dinner we went out to the piazza and lit off sparklers and some Roman candles, very appropriate, and some firecrackers. The kids had a great time. And then shortly before midnight, we headed up to the roof to watch the real fireworks display, which is impromptu, decentralized, and rising up from all quarters of Rome. And starting a couple minutes before midnight, the Romans started shooting off the fireworks, and it was really spectacular. We didn't lose any fingers, no casualties, no serious burns. So we made it through New Year's Eve. It was a lot of fun. Billy particularly got a kick out of it. You know, he's at that age where I hate to say it, but guys, let's face it. If you're a knack victim, if you're a solder smoke melter, you know that we all go through a certain pyrotechnic phase, and I think that's that's kicking in with Billy. He was quite enthused about the fireworks this year. There's an old Roman tradition of throwing all kinds of horrendous stuff out the window at midnight. And I mean all kinds of horrendous, disgusting stuff goes flying out the window, or did in the old days. I'm happy to report that tradition, at least in this part of Rome, is pretty much ended. Although we didn't tempt fate. We were not down on the sidewalk at midnight. We were safely up on the roof and out of range of anything that might be flying out the window. But a good time was had by all. Very nice New Year's Eve and a good start for 2009. Also wanted to report on our snow trip. I think I made mention in the last episode of the fact that we were thinking about taking the kids out to see the snow, and we did. We went out to a place called Campo Felice, which is in the province of Abruzzo, which is only about an hour and 20 minutes from Rome. And this shows you the real diversity of this country. If we drove 30 minutes in one direction, we'd be on the beach, and we've actually had the kids on the beach, kind of putting their feet in the water in December, on a warm day. This year we went an hour and 20 minutes in the opposite direction, up into the Apennine Hills, and went to a place called Campo Felice, which is a little ski resort up there. It's not really heavily developed. There's not a lot of hotels, but there's a few places, a few restaurants, some ski lifts, some places where you can rent some gear. And we rented some sleds for the kids and let them slide down the hill for the afternoon, had some hot chocolate there, had a snowball fight and let the kids see the snow. So it was great fun. And we got some good pictures. I'll put some pictures up on the Blogspot page. Hey, speaking of snow and Christmassy developments, there's been a big new development in QRP land, and it is related to the Christmas season because it has actually sparked a bit of Christmas poetry from N4QA. He was monitoring this. There's been a lot of discussion on the QRPL list. I'll read you the poetry from N4QA, and you'll know what I'm talking about. Michael the Red-Nosed Rainy, you'll go down in history. N4QA there is obviously referring to a new development on the QRP scene from Alpha Alpha 1 Tango Juliet, the hero of the Hobbit Hole, the QRP Poet Laureate. Mike Rainey has come up with really an innovative and amazing piece of gear. He's taken one of these compact fluorescent light bulbs, the CFL bulbs. You know, these are the bulbs that we've all been told to change to because they consume less electricity. They help with the environment. I just this summer switched over to these CFL bulbs here in the shack because the shack is so small that three or four of the conventional incandescent bulbs were really heating the place up and contributing to the load on the air conditioner. So I switched over for purely comfort purposes here. Michael has discovered, and I don't know how he made this discovery, he has discovered that in the base of these bulbs, and this is not an April Fool's joke, guys. I mean, this is the kind of thing that would really make you think that that we're trying to pull one over on you. And I briefly thought about this, but Michael has discovered that there are electronic components in the base of these CFL bulbs. And there apparently are enough of the key components in there, not absolutely everything you need, but the key components are in there to make an 80-meter CW transmitter. And Michael has made one, and he calls it the Derelict, like the derelict light bulb, the Derelict. He's got it up on his webpage. It's really interesting. And it has attracted the attention not only of poets like N4QA, but he recently made the Make blog, the Make Maker blog, the one that we've been talking about recently, the one that's recently, I think, made a very very welcome return to the world of electronics and a turn towards soldering irons and away from knitting needles. Michael's Derelict rig is now featured on the Make blog, and it has also attracted the attention of the editors of that fine QRP publication, Sprat, of the GQRP Club. It'll be featured on Sprat pretty soon. So you really got to check out Mike's CFL rig. Just Google AA1TJ, and you'll be taken to his site. It's really something to see, and a real excellent example of ham radio ingenuity. Congratulations on Michael. Still on the Christmas theme, a piece of gear arrived under the tree. Santa Claus brought Billy a new one of these new webbook kind of mini laptop PCs. There was some discussion about this on QRPL. It was very timely discussion because I was trying to decide on this one, and these things got really good reviews from the from ham radio users. And Mrs. Claus went out and went to one of the local electronic shops here and came back with an Asus, that's an ASUS EPC, that's a triple EPC. And I got to tell you guys, this is a very nice piece of gear. We got it for 175 euros, which I guess these days is about 200 bucks. And I'm telling you, this thing worked right out of the box. The battery was charged. We opened the thing up, flipped the battery in there, turned it on, runs Linux. The software was loaded up in about 15 seconds. And all kinds of software in there. Surfed the web. I just plugged in the password for the Wi-Fi network here in the house. And that was all it took, man. This thing just took off. It had started connecting to web pages. Billy's running his blog off of it right now. And really an impressive piece of gear. No moving parts. No hard drive. The hard drive is all kind of flash memory electronic. No spinning magnetic disks in there. So it's really very... kid durable, a good piece of gear. I'm of course now thinking that that Santa himself needs one. All kinds of things that we could do with that. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that was one of the more important technological Christmas gifts under the tree. Also in the Christmas season here, I guess this is appropriate at Christmas because it has to do with flashing red lights. I think I told you guys I've been feeling the lure of logic. The attraction of the glowing numerals, and also the need to fix my broken frequency counter. Longtime listeners will recall that several episodes ago, when I was afflicted with a real bout of enthusiasm for QRSS, slow-speed CW, manned experimental propagation transmitters and all that, right at the worst possible moment, my frequency counter went toes up and left me unable to precisely measure frequency, which is really important in the QRSS game because the width of the entire band is only 100 hertz. So you got to be right in there. And if you're off by 60 hertz, you can be out of the band. Anyway, you know how it is. When you have a piece of gear that it's broken and you can't fix it, it just bugs you. You know, you should be able to fix that. You shouldn't have anything in the shack that you really can't fix. That would make you, well, you know, kind of, you know, an appliance operator. And gosh, you know, we don't want that one. But anyway, this thing was sitting there kind of staring at me. It's a Global Specialties Corporation 6000 frequency counter. It looks like it's vintage around 1983. I picked it up at the Kempton Park rally outside of London several years ago. It worked fine when I got it, but then recently just kind of went nuts and all kinds of crazy numbers coming on the display, multiple decimal points, and that turned out to be an important clue. But it wasn't counting properly, and well, it started to bug me. It's been sitting there kind of glaring at me, and when the Christmas holidays rolled around, I had a little bit of extra time. I pulled this thing out and started to do some digital logic troubleshooting. Now, I haven't done anything like this since about 1977. As you guys know, I'm almost exclusively an analog kind of radio amateur. But I'm open to change. Anyway, I have done some digital logic kind of stuff, but it was a long time ago. It was at Fort Gordon, Georgia, 1977, and I went through the what they call the 31 Lima program, which was the multi-channel communications equipment repair course. I went through this course in record time only because I wanted to get out of Fort Gordon. And as soon as you finish the course, they let you go. And I became the honor grad, not so much out of electronic skill and enthusiasm, but by a desire, because of a desire to get the heck out of Fort Gordon, Georgia. But anyway, it was all about digital logic and digital troubleshooting. I guess in an era when you actually did some of this stuff down at component level, and it wasn't just a matter of changing one big chip. And that's sort of like Global Specialties Corporation 6000 rig is like. There's a whole bunch of individual CMOS chips in there. The manual that came with the piece of test gear isn't all that good. It really doesn't describe the circuit all that well, but it gave me enough to figure out what was going on. And the malfunction itself provided some clues. I noticed that the counter worked when I set the gate time to 10 seconds, when I put the gate time at 10 seconds, the counter counted perfectly. Also, if I selected the B or UHF input, the problem with multiple decimals and confused numbers seemed to disappear. So this, I knew, was an important clue and helped me when I went in there with my oscilloscope probe to kind of focus in on the parts of the circuit that were most likely to be causing the trouble. Now, it's been a long time since I worked on any of this kind of stuff, and it's a whole different world when you move into the digital logic area. But I managed, because of the clues, I managed to get in there, and I just asked myself, okay, what are these switches on the front panel? What are these gate timing switches? What are they actually switching? I knew that the switch that took you from kind of HF to UHF inputs just switched two different sets of input amplifiers and filters. But I took a look at what these gate timing switches were doing, and I focused in on the on what they eventually sent to the kind of the core counter chip. Also, the fact that when it was malfunctioning, there were two decimal points being displayed. That was another key point. So I started also looking at the part of the circuitry that determined where the decimal point was placed. I was really assisted when I was able to download the data sheet for the main chip. That was really really very useful, because I was able to see which pin really was responsible for placing the decimal point. So I went back from that pin, and I found that when I put the gate select switch in the other positions, sure enough, on the scope I could see two, not one, but two pulses for the decimal point. So then it became just a matter of going back and seeing where that problem was coming from, and I was able to trace it back to one chip that was just a bunch of CMOS gates that managed the placement of the decimal point and kind of set things up for the main counter chip to display the right kind of numbers and the right kind of sequence and all that. I gotta tell you, it was a really very satisfying troubleshoot. I'm a big fan of troubleshooting. This may go back to my Fort Gordon days, but you know, when you get a complicated piece of gear and you could go in there and it's electronic detective work, and it's of course the hardest part of fixing something. Once you find the bad part, the rest is pretty easy. But I always find a good troubleshoot very satisfying. When a piece of gear is broken, I often find myself hoping that it's something serious and complex and not just a matter of a stuck relay or something that needs a squirt of deoxit or WD-40 or something like that. Those kind of repairs are too easy. You know what I'm talking about. You're looking for something in there that is a real component gone bad, something complex, something deep in the innards of the circuitry that has gone bad and that is challenging you to find it. And that's what happened with this repair. Actually, what I traced it down to was one set of bad gates on one particular chip called a CD4019 chip. And I'm absolutely certain that that's the defective part. The inputs going into it are fine. But on that one particular segment, the outputs are bad. And there's one chip in there that is supposed to be functioning as an AND gate or an OR gate, and it's not doing it. And so it's letting the output go through for some settings of the front panel switches in which one of the outputs should be blocked. It perfectly explains the symptoms that I'm seeing on the counter, and I'm certain that's it. Now I need, also it's a CMOS chip, and you know, these kind of chips are kind of sensitive to static. Something could have gone in there and just perforated the little the thing there at the gate of some of these gates. So it's these chips are sort of vulnerable to voltage spikes or static discharge or something like that. So something got some of these gates in there. If anybody knows or anybody has sitting in the junk box a little CD4019 chip, please let me know. But anyway, that's my tale of a very satisfying Christmas troubleshoot. And I really enjoyed going through this thing. And now it's kind of pulled me into the world of digital logic and glowing numerals. You know, I told you a while back that Jerry, our man in South Dakota, had sent me one of these little counter kits by Doug N3ZI. These were the $9.99 frequency counters. Jerry had heard about my suffering with QRSS and the MEPT and my efforts to get in the band, and he figured that one of these counters would help me, so he sent me one. And it's been waiting here for construction, and now in my burst of digital logic enthusiasm, I decided to go ahead and build it. So I put it together. It went together very easily. I built it on one of these little Vero boards. I had a little bit of trouble. I was sure it was an operator problem, and it turned out to be. But I was able to get into email contact with Doug, N3ZI, and he very kindly and very quickly pointed me in the right direction, and we got the thing going. I built a little balsa wood box for it. You can see what I'm talking about if you go to the Solder Smoke News blog page. That's soldersmoke.blogspot.com. You could see a picture of Doug's counter, my version of it, sitting up on top of my 80-meter double sideband kick panel transmitter. Works like a charm. It's really cool to tune this little homebrew rig around and see a very accurate frequency readout there in numerals. Really cool. I power my counter. I'm really kind of proud of this innovation. I needed to come up with a way to power it. It needs about 4.5 volts or so. And I think Doug had mentioned that he powers one of his with these little kind of hearing aid batteries. And I had a bunch of these floating around at the shack. So I took three of them, put them in series, and fashioned a little kind of battery holder for them. Used some crazy glue, some PC board, one of these little battery clips from an old that Radio Shack used to sell to hold a 9-volt battery in place. I used the kind of spring tension from that battery holder to hold the three batteries in series. And there you have it. That's a little internal supply, 4.5 volts for the frequency counter. Great fun to put together. Also, I want to mention balsa. We have a lot of artist supply stores here in this neighborhood. It's a very kind of artsy neighborhood, so you can get all kinds of painting and framing and sculpture supplies. They sell a lot of this balsa wood. It's not really like really thin balsa. It's about 1/4 inch thick. It's strong enough and solid enough to make a little nice little cabinet for a project like this. Very easy to cut. So I cut out 4 pieces of it and made a little wraparound cabinet, put the whole thing together with crazy glue and some duct tape. Makes a nice little cabinet for the counter, and I recommend the use of this stuff for similar projects. This could be a real good project cabinet material. I'm not very good at the cabinet making, but this stuff was very easy to work with and went together really well. Again, you can see a picture of it here on the site. You know, there's and I also have a link you can click on a link to Doug's website for the frequency counter. I think you guys would be interested in getting one of those. They're very useful for a variety of projects. I want to get one for the Drake 2B to take care of my dial parallax problem. Can you imagine that? Digital readout on the Drake 2B? It's just tremendously exciting. I'm not the only one who is going through this kind of digital logic revolution, or a digital logic rebirth, I guess. Todd, VE7BPO, this is a fellow who's really well known in the QRP SWL homebrew community. He's got a website that you've all visited. He's got a really fantastic homebrew website. I think it's Pops QRP, but he's going through. I'm going to put a link to the site up on the Blogspot page. But if I'm late in doing that, just Google VE7 Bravo Papa Oscar. This is the QRP SWL homebrew site. Todd is going through a similar kind of digital logic phase. He's got all kinds of digital logic stuff and experiments. Todd, you could tell, Todd is a real hardcore home brewer, because when he wanted to come up with the digital displays, he didn't just go out and buy the standard seven-segment LED glowing numeral displays. No, no. He went out and made his own numerical displays out of individual LEDs. He took a piece of PC board and drilled little circular holes in the familiar pattern, and then put individual LEDs in there, and came up with experiments and chip circuits that would count and do all kinds of the standard digital logic things with homebrew homebrew LED displays. So fine business, Todd. You are a true digital wizard. I want to also note that another digital wizard that really this really was interesting for me when I was trying to figure out how some of these circuits work, and of course I'm still in the process. I went to one of my favorite editions of the Radio Amateur Handbook, the 1983 edition. This was particularly good. I think Doug DeMaul was the lead on this one. And in there's a circuit, one of Doug's circuits, a homebrew counter that Doug made. Very simple, but sophisticated at the same time, and a very kind of a neat circuit and homebrew digital logic. I just thought it was really pretty cool. So wanted to mention that. All right, so this all contributes now to the QRSS MEPT effort, and I guess we should have a segment here called MEPT News. The Knights of the QRSS, if you guys are interested in it, you should sign up for the mailing list, because that's how information is exchanged among MEPT people. I'm really pleased that there's so much new QRSS and MEPT activity in the States, and some guys are saying that the discussions here on Solder Smoke are responsible for some of this. That's great, because we're starting to see grabbers and transmitters popping up all across North America. Previously, this had been mostly a European thing. I'm not quite sure why, but there's a lot of stateside and Canadian activity now, so that's great. And one of the real gurus of QRSS, the guy who brought a lot of us into this particular kind of ham radio madness, is Hans Sommers, G0UPL. Hans wrote a number of really great articles for Sprat. His web pages have been a real treasure trove of information in this area. And Hans, I'm happy to report, is back on the air from London with a QRSS transmitter. I've been watching him. I can see him on the I2NDT on Claudio's repeater up in northern Italy. I could see Hans's signal reaching northern Italy quite easily. That it's real good to see Hans on the air. My own LED problems, I mentioned I had some LED problems with my transmitter. They're all sorted out. My rig is on the air. I'm looking at the little LED flashing right now. Flashing very slowly, of course, but indicating that my rig is on the air and is modulating. My transmitter, my 50 milliwatt transmitter, for some reason has a pipeline to the receive station of Johan ON5EX up there in Belgium. You know, some days I'm visible in multiple European grabbers, but I'm almost always from sunup to sundown very, very prominent in Johan's grabber. So if you guys want to see what my signal looks like on any given day, if it's daytime in Europe, go to the ON5EX grabber, and you'll see my little upside-down frequency shift keying signal there, just belting out constantly I0 stroke N2 CQR. That's what it's saying. Got to read it along the bottom line because the frequency shift keying is upside down, but there it is. Lawrence, KL1X, guy that we've mentioned, is now in operation there in northern China, and he has a grabber going, and he's starting to pick up signals from VK land. Nothing prominent yet. He's using a real simple, what he calls, baby bottle probe antenna. Apparently, it's a very short antenna with an RF amp in it, up protected by a baby bottle up on the roof of his house there in northern China. But he's taking the results of this and putting it on the web, and we're starting to see what we think are QRSS signals from VK land making it into to Lawrence's grabber there in northern China. So this is all, of course, very, very interesting. I was talking about my signals going into the ON5EX grabber. They're so solid and steady that I've been thinking about making antenna adjustments while watching Johann's grabber. You know, I go over there, and if I tweak the antenna or tweak the tuner, if my signal on the screen gets brighter, I know that I've moved in the right direction. If it grows dimmer, I know that I'm going in the wrong direction. So it's kind of an interesting way to make adjustments to the to the antenna and transmitter system. All right. So that's the MEPT news for the week. And good luck to all the QRSS slow-speed folks out there. We're really having a lot of fun with this. Sort of miscellaneous news, just odds and ends here. I noticed that Dan's Small Parts has some real good deals on there. I'm ordering. I'm running out of bypass capacitors and low-value resistors here, so I'm going to be sending an order off to Dan. Dan's got some good deals on his website. Check those out. In terms of the Solder Smoke Book of the Week, I picked up a copy of Empire of the Air by Tom Lewis. I'm sure you guys have heard this book. It's all about DeForest and Armstrong and Sarnoff, three very different people, but very deeply involved in the early days of broadcast radio. And I have the video. The video is really good. I really enjoyed the video, but I never had the book. And I'm going through the book right now. And I think, of course, the favorite character in this book, and I think he'll be the favorite character for the personality book, favorite personality for you guys also, is by far Armstrong. I don't think DeForest, he doesn't come across very well, and probably for good reason, but Armstrong does, and Armstrong really comes across as the true radio amateur. And the really great quotes in here about Armstrong. I'll read one to you from page 60. Among the children of the neighborhood, Howard earned a reputation for being able to fix almost any broken toy. When he grew older, he would take his tools to a nearby road leading to New York. There, he would wait for automobiles, still a novelty, to break down so that he might fix them. Man, that is a sign of a troubleshooter. From the three windows of his room underneath the cupola on the top floor of the house, Howard had a commanding view of the Hudson and the Palisades. The space and relative distance from the rest of the family offered an excellent place for him to construct radio equipment. Indeed, he had a shack. By this time, the house had electric light, and Howard suspended two lamps from the ceiling over his work table so that he might work through the night. The man is a fiend. His was the highest point in the house, the place where he could best send and receive wireless signals. His parents helped him to acquire the necessary wireless paraphernalia. Good use of the word there, because that does kind of conjure up the what's going on here. Including induction coils, coherers, a telegrapher's key, and earphones, Leyden jars, and condensers. And he busied himself constructing and experimenting with electrical circuits. Very clearly, Armstrong was one of us. Then they talk a little bit about here what he did once he got going. Soon Armstrong was receiving and sending wireless messages to other boys and young men who were also taken with Marconi's invention. They became his circle of companions. Two, Tom Stiles, who lived down the hill from his house, and Randy Runyon, who lived about a mile away, closer to the center of Yonkers, became lifelong and unfailing friends and valued assistants in his experiments. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you find here in Tom Lewis's book. I'm really enjoying it. We all, I think, know the story of what went on and the terrible litigation and patent fights that went on afterwards, and that eventually, ended up taking Armstrong's life. There, it was a terrible, terrible, terrible ending. And I think a lot of us, as radio amateurs, kind of end up thinking badly about Sarnoff and DeForest. Sarnoff, though, as I'm reading through the chapters, comes across as a much more positive character. I didn't have a whole lot of information before about his very, very rough and difficult immigrant background, coming from the area now known as Belarus, and how the family struggled and how he struggled on the streets of New York as a new immigrant. So Sarnoff, I think, comes across in a much more positive light than he does in other descriptions of the book of the struggle between the three. But anyway, there it is, Empire of the Air. I might read bits and pieces more of it as we go by. I'm just getting started with it now, but a really good book. And speaking about collaborators in ham radio, that brings us to
time for
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. Todd K5TAK thinks that we need a better name for victims of Dilbert's disease. You know, I haven't been talking too much about the K word, because I got some email from some important folks saying that we were getting carried away with this whole Dilbert disease thing. But so I'll try to steer away from those kind of discussions. But Todd comes up with a suggestion for a change in terminology, that we not call people NAC victims, but we refer to them as something like master electron choreographers. I'm sorry, Todd. I tried to give this one a chance, but no, man, it's just not happening. No. No. Definitely not. If anybody thinks I'm wrong, please send in an email. But no, we just can't use the word choreography when discussing radio. It's just, there are two activities that are just so far apart. No. Sorry. But thanks for the try, Todd, and thanks for the message. We gave it a shot. As I read it, I just knew, this is not going to happen. Rick, KC0PET, writes in and reports that he's enjoying Solder Smoke and now has a new scope, an antenna analyzer, and an LC meter. Fine business there, Rick. Good luck with the new test gear. Bill Kelsey, NADT of Kanga, USA, reports that Kanga is getting back up to speed. He's kitting up some UQRP kits. Then he's going to be putting together some KK7B micro R2 and T2 kits to be used for some sort of project that is brewing. I'm not quite sure what's going on there, but something interesting is happening in Kanga, USA, so stay tuned. Soon he's going to put together some ZOI spectrum analyzer kits. Definitely very interesting. Thanks for the word on that, Bill. Good luck with Kanga, USA. Alan, WA9IRS, sent me a link to a really amazing site, and I've put this up. It's already up on the blog page on Solder Smoke News at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. A fellow named Pete Millett, who is an electrical engineer, has decided, really in an act of electromagnetic altruism, decided to take old electronic books that are no longer covered by copyright, and scan them and make them available free as PDF files online. And I'm telling you guys, there is a real, you talk about a treasure trove. This is a treasure trove of ham radio, well, not necessarily ham radio, but radio electronic information. It's all there, and free downloads. Pete Millett, really, thanks a lot. From on behalf of all the Solder Smoke listeners, this is a really great site. So check it out, and thanks to Alan for sending that along. Wayne, VA7AT, encourages me to move into software designed radio. Wayne, as you can tell from this episode, I'm moving in that direction. Thanks very much. He sent me all along a list of that old comedy routine, how you can tell if you're a redneck. Well, this is how you can tell if you have the knack. It's been bouncing around QRPL, and Wayne sent that along. It seemed to me that this list was, it really wasn't for knack victims. It was really for kind of generic ham radio enthusiasts. But there wasn't a whole lot in there about constructing and melting solder and designing stuff and solder smoke and PC boards and really our kind of stuff. But there's some potential there, and I'm sure somebody will come up with some sort of list like that that is more oriented towards our particular corner of the radio game. Got an email from Frank, VK2AKG. He wants to point out that he is not the artist, and if you could call it that, behind the solenoid concert YouTube video that we mentioned in the last episode. He was just passing it along. Frank claims that he has no musical talent and was not the one who made the music with the solenoids. So I'm sorry if I created the wrong impression there, but there you have it. I think if you look at the YouTube video, it clearly identifies who the artist is. And thanks for Frank for passing that along. And thanks for the guy who made the solenoid music. Kind of interesting. Got some real interesting email from Bill, N3HQB. A while back, Bill sent me, was very kind to send me a filter to stop the popping sounds that we were hearing through the very rudimentary solder smoke microphone. There's a picture of the solder smoke microphone on the blog. If you dig back through the archives, you can find it. But anyway, Bill wanted to help out, and he sent me one of these. It's kind of hard to describe. It was something to do with cheese, but it's a filter, and it helps prevent the popping, the P percussion, Peter Piper sound from reaching the microphone and producing that annoying pop. But anyway, when he sent this along, he also sent a QSL card and a note, and I really didn't focus on this until last night. I'd read it, but then somehow I must have been busy when I got it, and it didn't really click. But on the back of his QSL card, he said here, P.S., AID, K8EEG, W0RSP, was my Elmer. See History of QRP, pages 13 and 14. Now, I remember pages 13 and 14 from History of QRP, from AID Weiss's wonderful book. And it was this discussion of his work as a ham radio camp counselor. I can remember as a kid reading those ads in the back of QST magazine in which they asked for hams, teenage hams with radio licenses to go out to be radio amateur kind of camp counselors and teach the kids to be ham radio operators over the summer. I was tempted. I never got to actually do it, but Adrian Weiss, W0RSP, did. And on page 13 and 14 of his book, he describes the experience in helping these kids get their novice licenses and actually helping them build a real piece of radio gear. Now, on page 13 and 14, Aid describes one particular kid who was a bit difficult, who was basically a rich kid who gave him a lot of trouble. But in the end, ended up being a successful radio builder, and I assume a successful radio amateur. When I got this note from Bill, N3HQB, my first thought was, oh no, I wonder if Bill was the problematic rich kid that Aide mentioned. And so we got a quick exchange of emails, and we were able to settle that issue. No, Bill was not the kid who gave Aide a lot of trouble. Bill was just one of the kids in the class who got their novice license and who can now legitimately claim that Adrian Weiss, W0RSP, author of History of QRP in the U.S. 1924 to 1960, was his Elmer. What a great Elmer to have. And thanks for that info, Bill. We'd really like to get Aide here on the show. I think that would be great fun. Bill suggested that, and I hope we can make it happen. Roger, N7RXV, sent a nice note about grinding resistors to get precision values. I think I said it wrong. When you think about grinding the resistor, you think about reducing, taking ohms away, almost like whittling the ohms away or grinding them away. But, of course, that doesn't make any sense. As you remove the material, you're going to be reducing the conductivity of the device. And so when you grind them, you're actually increasing the value of R, and Roger points that out. Thanks a lot. I one day want to grind resistors. I want to get a resistor that's not quite high enough in value and get out that little file and grind it down until it's exactly where I want it. Homebrew, almost homebrew resistors. Very interesting. Thanks for that, Roger. Dino, KL0S, writes in and says that he's found, in addition to the Pete Millett's free online tech books, found two other sources from Georgia Tech and DC Tech of technical textbooks online. So I'll try to get the links up to that for that up onto the page. Gareth, G1DRG, points out that the BBC has a podcast called Digital Planet and has had some podcasts in there of interest. I've had some trouble getting some of the Beebs, especially their video products. They have some great video products, great programming on there. But for some reason, not available to folks outside the United Kingdom. Too bad. We hope the BBC fixes that up, and so we can take a look at some of these great products. But thanks, Gareth, for pointing out to us the Digital Planet program on the BBC. Take a listen. It sounds very interesting. I want to thank let me reach for it here. Let's see. I want to thank Tim Walford of Somerset, England, for sending along another issue of Hot Iron, the Journal of the Constructors Club. You know, it's a kind of a weird kind of linguistic thing here. UK listeners, when they hear me say solder smoke, their pronunciation of solder is different from the American pronunciation. They pronounce the L in the UK. I think we've discussed this before. So they say solder, soldering. And, of course, in the States we just say soldering. It's a soldering iron. Well, I have to explain to our American listeners, our British cousins have to be careful about that pronunciation because soldering is a completely different activity in the UK vernacular. We're not going to go into details. This is a family show. You can imagine what I'm talking about. But the converse is often true also. I mean, Tim has a really wonderful publication. I enjoy it. It's great. I wish it was online so we could more easily share it with people. But it's the Journal of the Constructors Club, and the title of it is Hot Iron. And I had it on the desk, and my wife kind of looked at it at one point, and I think she said to me, what the heck are you reading there, Hot Iron? And I had it at work one time, and I was kind of – the title there just – I don't know. It just – well, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it's a wonderful publication. Tim, thanks for sending it along. There were a couple things in there that really caught my eye. One, an article on page two of Pulling Ceramic Resonators Higher in Frequency. And he points out in there that it's been discovered, and I want to claim credit. I think I was the original discoverer of this. That if you put two of it says here, an interesting characteristic of ceramic resonators is that when they are connected in parallel, they have a higher resonant frequency than either of them connected on their own. And that is the basis of the frequency control of my 20-meter double sideband transceiver. I have a little switch there that takes me from 14.266 14.304, and in the down position is 282 to 322. I wrote this up in Spratt. It's in Spratt. It's all been certified there. So I'm glad somebody else has discovered this and is making use of it. And also, I know that Tim Walford and I are kind of like-minded people here, because he's also got an article in here about modifying and making use of those wonderful little Ramsey MOSFET amplifiers and using them on other bands. I have one here that I've tortured and changed frequency on and changed the low-pass filter on it so many times that you can hardly even recognize what the original band was. But, Tim, thanks very much for sending along your Hot Iron publication. We always look forward to receiving it, and I really recommend that other people get in touch with Tim so that you can get this very fine publication. Some updates on the blog. I want to note I put a link to a YouTube video from KC9KEP. This fella has put together a really beautiful homebrew super heterodyne, or it might be a little bit regenerative, receiver. Really, really great stuff. Really fine workmanship. I really enjoyed looking at his video. I think you guys will get a kick out of that. That's the currently the top item on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Below that, I have some pictures of my 75-meter kick panel rig with the N3ZI frequency counter up on top. There's a link to the free electronic books that were mentioned by Alan WA9IRS. There's a link in there about recent changes on the web SDR receive project out of the Netherlands, with a really amazing picture of a of kind of dead bug construction using a chip with entirely too many output leads, but really great stuff. N0TU is putting together a video about straight kyanite. So speaking of kind of provocative titles, we have SKN, and it looks like Skinfleck. So you'll see, if you see Skinfleck, you realize it's not actually a Skinfleck. It's a straight kyanite flick. The trailer, the lead-in portion of it has been completed by N0TU. Really artistic work, great stuff. That's up there. And finally, a new addition to the blogspot.com page, some pictures of the beacon that were the beacon device that was on the Echo satellite, the big satellite that NASA inflated like a balloon, the silvery satellite that flew over the world in 1960, and many of you probably remember going out and looking at as it flew over. There was an electronic transmitter on there. W2DU worked on it, and I got some pictures that he posted on the AM phone mailing list that you guys can take a look at. Really interesting stuff. Guys, that brings us to the end of Solder Smoke 98. I'm going to have a little public service announcement at the end here about advertising and other business issues. But thanks very much for listening. And I hope 2009 gets off to a good start for all of you. And 7-3 from Rome. Hey, thanks for listening to Solder Smoke. We have a lot of fun putting it together and are really delighted to have so many listeners around the world. Our listeners sometimes ask what they can do to help support the podcast. Fortunately, our expenses are quite modest, so we're not facing any kind of Solder Smoke financial crisis. But there are a few things that listeners could do to help us out. First, please spread the word about the show, not only to fellow hams, but to other technically inclined people who might be interested. Please put links to the show on your own blogs and web pages. Please link to the Solder Smoke news page. That's soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Advertisements on our blog page and web pages help pay the bills. If you're going to buy something from Amazon, please enter the Amazon website through the link on the Solder Smoke news page. It's up in the upper right-hand side of the page. It's easy to find. And if you enter Amazon through that page, theoretically, we get a bit of money from Amazon.com. Not from you, but from Amazon. So we're happy to have that link on our page. Finally, we're thinking about including some audio ads in the show. We'd only take ads from organizations of direct interest to our listeners. We're thinking about taking ads from small kit and parts suppliers, specialty book publishers, the kinds of organizations that advertise in the ham radio publications of direct interest to solder smoke listeners and knack victims and people who melt solder and build things electronic. We think it might be a way to help pay some of the bills and provide content that would be of interest to our listeners. So, if you'd be interested in placing an ad that could reach directly the 3,000 to 4,000 loyal Solder Smoke listeners around the world, please contact me at n2cqr@yahoo.com. Thanks a lot.